I think there's some great lessons we can learn from these prophets. One thing is we learn that God rules in the kingdom of men. That when men do right, God blesses them. When they don't, God always destroys them eventually. But it gives them opportunity. That's what he was doing through Amos and Hosea, trying to get Israel to turn back to him, that they might be saved. But through their idolatry and apostasy in every way, and their wickedness, murdering their kings and all that, God's going to carry them into captivity, and that's what he's going to do. So that's what we're trying to learn, is God, how God rules, how God directs the affairs of the world, as well as in his own kingdom. Now, in chapter 8, 6 and 7, he was dealing there with the rulers, the princes primarily. Now then he comes to the whole nation itself, the nation's idolatry. Now, he begins, set the trumpet to thy mouth. As an eagle, he cometh against the house of Jehovah, because they have transgressed my covenant and trespassed against my law. Now look at the alternate reading. I like the alternate reading, the marginal reading. The trumpet to thy mouth, as an eagle against the house of Jehovah. In other words, the short, to the point statements, to the mouth of the trumpet. Now, as I said before, the trumpet warns, or the trumpet may call to war. There were a number of purposes of the trumpet. So here the idea is the trumpet to the mouth, because the Assyrians are coming. They're on their way. Fear soon. All right, now he cometh against the house of Jehovah. Now the house there is the family of Jehovah. Because Noah said, because they, the house, have transgressed my covenant and trespassed against my law. They should cry unto me, my God, we Israel know thee, so that we Israel indicates the house. So the house here is not a building, but it's the family, the nation of Israel. Now they transgressed his covenant. Now, God made two covenants with his people back in Deuteronomy. In the fifth chapter, we have the covenant of Mount Sinai. And that's the covenant in which the people became the people of God. Then in the 28th chapter, in the 29th, here he makes another covenant. Now this covenant that he makes here is a covenant concerning the land. Well, you'll notice here in the 29th chapter here, now these are the words of the covenant which Jehovah commanded Moses to make with the children of Israel in the land of Moab, besides the covenant which he made with them in Horeb. So see, when they came out of Egypt to Horeb, it was about 2 or 3 months after, God brought them to Sinai and made the covenant with the Ten Commandments as the basis of it with the people there. Then, before they entered the land of Canaan, some 38 years later, he made another covenant in the borders of Moab concerning the land. Now that covenant is contained in the 28th chapter. Now, in that chapter, you have the blessings and the curse. First of all, now if you hearken unto Jehovah here, unto his voice, here are the blessings, in verses 1 through 14. Now here are the blessings, if you comply with and keep my covenant. Now then, beginning with verse 15, but it shall come to pass, if thou wilt not hearken unto the voice of Jehovah thy God, to observe to do all his commandments and his statutes, which I command you this day, for all these curses shall come upon thee and overtake thee. All right, now that's what he means here in Hosea, when he says they have transgressed the covenant. God made a covenant on certain conditions. I'll bless you. You'll retain this land as long as you're a nation. If you don't, then I'm going to carry you into a foreign nation. He goes on in the next few verses there, telling him what they'll do here. How the land will be cursed, and they'll be carried away. Verse 49, Jehovah will bring a nation against thee from far, upon the end of the earth, as the eagle flies, a nation whose tongue thou shalt not understand. So you see what he has said back here in the covenant is what Hosea has in mind. When he said, put the trumpet to the mouth, the eagle's coming. God said, I'll bring a nation as down upon you, and the eagle swoops down upon his prey. So I'll bring a nation against you to swoop down upon you, don't you see? And that's what's coming to place now. Then drop down to 53. And thou shalt eat the fruit of thine own body, the flesh of thy sons and thy daughters, whom Jehovah thy God hath given thee, in the siege, and in the distress wherewith thine enemies shall distress thee. Then he speaks of these coming here whose language you do not understand. All right, now look at verse 29. Now these are the words of the covenant which Jehovah commanded Moses here at Moab with this covenant in Deuteronomy 28. So we have two covenants. The covenant made them the people of God at Sinai, and the covenant here at the borders of Moab, in which he says, you'll retain this land. I'm giving it to you, but on condition that you keep my covenant. Otherwise, you'll be cast into a foreign land. Now, here's an interesting thing. God gave the land unto the nation in fulfillment of the promise to Abraham. So the receiving of the land was unconditional. The retaining of the land was conditional. So God's going to give it to you, going to promise it to Abraham. You're going to retain it if you keep the covenant that I made with you at Mount Sinai. Now, I think if you keep that in mind always, you have a better understanding of what God has done with the Jews. Why, he cast them out of the land, and he brought them back. Then when they rejected the Christ, he cast them off. They are no more the people of God than the people of South Africa or North Russia. It doesn't make any difference. All are exactly alike before him today. The only people of God today are those who are in covenant with him in Christ Jesus. So the Jew doesn't mean any more to God than the blackest man in Africa or the whitest fellow in Russia or Sweden or wherever it may be. Doesn't matter. Or the reddest one on the reservations here in Arizona. All right. But now drop on. I want to look a little further. Now, look at the 30th chapter and the first few verses. Well, let's, in that 29th chapter, goes on to tell there how that these curses of the covenant was written in this book overtake you and go into a foreign land because they forsook the covenant of Jehovah in verse 25 of chapter 29. Now, in chapter 30, and it shall come to pass when all these things are come upon thee, the blessing and the curse, which I have set before thee, and thou shalt call them to mind among all the nations, where the Jehovah thy God hath driven thee, and shalt return unto Jehovah thy God, and shall obey his voice according to all that I command thee this day, thou and thy children with all thy heart, with all thy soul, that then Jehovah thy God will return thy captivity, have compassion upon thee, and will return and gather thee from all the peoples, whither Jehovah thy God hath scattered thee. And if there be any outcast, well, I'll gather them, he said. And verse 5, and Jehovah thy God will bring thee into the land which thy fathers possessed, and thou shalt possess it, and he will do thee good and multiply thee above thy fathers. And Jehovah thy God will circumcise thy heart, the heart of thy seed, to love Jehovah thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul, thou mayest live. Now, so what the remnant that he brought back would be a remnant that would return unto him with the heart. Then, of course, there was going to be a second time he set his hand to recover a remnant. That's the spiritual remnant. So God has recovered two different remnants. The remnant that he brought back under Zerubbabel and Joshua the high priest, and later on whatever the next one was, I forget right now. But anyhow, he brought them back. That was the first recovery of a remnant. Now the second is a remnant according to the election of grace, which is under Christ. So those things that help us to understand the whole of the Bible. But I think one of the mistakes we so often make is we study just little patches of the Bible and never see a connection between the whole. In my teaching throughout 33 years I taught in college, I always tried to keep that before the students. From the beginning to the end of my class or course, whatever it might be, I was trying to get them to see these interrelationships of all these passages so they might have an overall picture of what God was doing from Genesis clear to Revelation and what he was doing with the Jews. Now, I'm going to begin this morning with some lessons on Galatians. And Galatians now deals with a problem that Paul faced in making the Jews see and understand the difference between the works of law and the faith of grace. And that was a hard problem. They couldn't see that. But if we go back and study what we're studying, what we're learning in the prophets, and associating that, then we understand why God cast them off, why we're not in the wrong with his people. Well, all right, let me drop down to one other verse here. Verse 10 in that 30th chapter. Now, if thou shalt obey the voice of Jehovah thy God to keep his commandments and his statutes, which are written in this book of the law, if thou turn unto Jehovah thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul. All right, now, there are your conditional ifs. God's going to bring them back and give them the land if they are turned to God with a heart. Well, a remnant did. But they hadn't been back home long, before they were beginning to drift away again. They never committed idolatry, never were idolaters again, but they allowed the philosophy of Greece through Alexander the Great, who came down into that country about 330 B.C., they accepted that Greek philosophy, and that led them away from God again. And so when Christ came, not knowing their law and not knowing their prophets, why, they rejected the Christ, and so God then destroyed the city, cast them out, and they're no longer his people. Yeah, and nothing more for them than death, you and me, out of it. Our nation doesn't understand that. because they don't know any more about the Bible than the old Jews did when they crucified Christ. Well, all right. Now, so he says here, so the trumpet of the eagle's coming now, swooping down on them. They've transgressed my covenant and trespassed against my law. They shall cry unto me, my God, we in Israel know thee. Israel hath cast off that which is good. The enemy shall pursue it. They want to cry, we know thee, because they know you don't know me. And they still don't know him. Had a letter from, oh no, a young lady out in California sent me a book a while back on the Sabbath by a modern day Jew. She thought it was a great book. It was filled with old Jewish ideas that are foreign to it. Then she mentioned in that to me, she'd been reading in Deuteronomy about when they went in to get the law there, and the two rabbis had different views. One had the view that God didn't give it to them for some reason. Another rabbi had another reason. I told her, I said, both your rabbis are wrong. God didn't give it to them because the iniquity of the Amorite was not yet full. When that came, then God cast them out and gave it to the Jew, not because of the Jew's righteousness, but because of the wickedness of the Canaanites. God never destroys a righteous people to give their land to somebody else. It's not until that nation is no longer fit to live that God ever destroys it. Now that's one lesson I hope, I wish, trust that I've gotten across in our studies of the Old Testament since I've been out here. If we all recognize the fact that God's in control, God casts a nation out, destroys it when it becomes no longer fit to live. As long as it's fit to live and enough salt to save it, he spares it. And that's the way he's going to treat this one. Same way. So it's up to us to see if the salt is preserved here. It'll always be enough. All right. The enemy shall pursue him. Now they have set up kings, but not by me. They have made princes, and I knew it not. Of their silver and their gold have they made them idols, that they may be cut off. What? Now these kings, they didn't check with God. Well, they set this king up, and that king, who had the most military power, then they'd kill him and set up another one there. That's in Israel now we're talking about. Right? Not only that, but they made them idols of gold and silver. We couldn't save them. And so God said, I'm going to cut you off. And he did cut them off by Assyria in 722. Now this is about 750 to 725, just 20, 25 years before the fall of Samaria to the Assyrians. He had cast off thy calf, O Samaria. Mine anger is kindled against them. That is against the idol, the people, rather, that made the calf there. Now, God's anger was against Jeroboam, the descendants there of Ephraim, who had built the calf. He was now against Samaria, who worshipped the calf. Now, remember that Jeroboam the first set up a golden calf at Bethel and another at Dan. And the people worshipped before the two of them there. But God wanted to cut off the people and cut off the idol, too, the idol that set up there. Excuse me. Now notice they asked the question, how long? And we'll cut it off. Now, my anger against you there. He was cast off by calf of Samaria. My anger is kindled against them. How long will it be ere they attain unto innocency? Well, that's a good question. He doesn't answer that question. I made that statement. I've read a number of questions. How long this, that. I only found one little question God ever answered. There may be some he did answer that I've overlooked. But in Isaiah the 6th chapter, when Isaiah asked, how long, O Lord? The Lord said, till the whole thing is destroyed and the captivity, you keep on preaching. So God didn't just answer that, because how long always pertains to God. How long? For from Israel is even this, the workman made it, and it is no God. Yea, the calf of Samaria shall be broken in pieces. It will be destroyed, it will be broken in pieces and carried away by the conquerors. For they sold the wind, and they shall reap the whirlwind. Now that's one of my texts last Sunday morning, if you recall, when I was talking about America's religious harvest. They sowed the wind, they shall reap the whirlwind. Right? That happened to Israel. That's happening to the United States. It's going to happen to all of them. When you sow the wind, you reap the whirlwind. Whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. He that soweth under his own flesh shall of the flesh reap corruption. He that soweth under the Spirit shall of the Spirit reap eternal life. Right? Now that's a principle with God. Just as true as if you sow wheat out here, you're going to get wheat. If you go out here and sow tares in it, you're going to get tares. If you sow weeds, you're going to get wheat. Whatever you sow, that's what you reap. So it is just as true with a nation as it is with an individual. Happens the same to both. All right? So they reap the whirlwind. He hath no standing grain. The blade shall yield no meal. If so be it yield meal, strangers shall swallow it up. So now then, in the whirlwind here, the tornado, the storm is coming that you're reaping. If you know standing grain, and if you, whatever you raise, or your enemy is going to eat it up. You won't get to. You'll be hungry. And that's what happened to them. All right, that's a great passage, isn't it? Israel is swallowed up. Now are they among the nations as a vessel, wherein none delighted. For they are gone up to Assyria like a wild ass alone by himself. Ephraim hath hired lovers. I read that one thing that sustains the wild ass there is the fact that he lives alone there. Well, Israel was supposed to live alone and not join himself to these nations. But now then, he's joining himself to these nations and going to Assyria to make a covenant with Assyria to try to save him. But the ones he tried to make a covenant with became the ones that destroyed him. Now that's often true. I think our own nation, I think all these alliances that's been making with foreign nations, all that will ultimately end in our own destruction. I don't think there's a nation on earth that really loves us. They want what we've got, but they don't like us. Maybe it's jealousy, maybe it's envy, I don't know what it is, doesn't matter. But I don't think many of them like us, but yet they all want to come over here. They don't like it, but they want to get over here because they think, well, if we just get to America, that's a land where everybody's rich. We belong, I'll be plentiful. But at any rate, that's a strange issue of wallowing up. All right. They go on to say here, vessel where none delighted, for they're gone up to Assyria like a wild ass alone by himself. Ephraim hath hired lovers. Nobody really liked love Ephraim, so but by tribute and alliances, why she hired her lovers. Whereas God expected to be alone, she was alone really, for none of them liked her, none of them loved her, wanted to see her destroyed, and yet she hired her lovers. Well, you remember our study in Ezekiel where we had that, where God said that Israel had done worse than a harlot. She had paid individuals to have relationships with her. Whereas generally you pay the harlot, but she paid the harlot and paid the other individual, worse than a harlot. Remember that back over in the 16th and the 23rd chapters of the book? Yea, though they hire among the nations, now will I gather them, and they begin to be diminished by reason of the burden of the king of princes. Well, the king of princes is Assyria. Now they go to Assyria trying to make an alliance, but the ones they try to make the alliance with will really be the ones that destroy them. And so I think that that will eventually happen by making all of our alliances and all of this giveaway that we've been doing now since World War II. Why, it's breaking us. We're going to be completely broke one of these days. We too will be a second-rate nation, but nobody's going to particularly care when that takes place. All right, but because of the ones whose favor we courted by giving away, they'll be the very one that ought to destroy us by taking everything that we're giving them, giving nothing back. I think you see some principles here, class. That's what I'm trying to get across. I want you to see some principles here on which you can deduce a correct conclusion, a judgment, with regard to our own country and what we've been doing and what we are doing now, and what will be the consequence of it. That, and the Bible deals with these principles all the way through. All right. Now, verse 11. Because Ephraim hath multiplied altars for sinning, altars have been unto him for sinning. Now, in multiplying these altars unto these heathen gods, while you sin in that, but they then in turn become the instruments through which you continue sinning. Continue sinning through these altars that you have made for sinning, really. Now, notice, I wrote for him the 10,000 things of my law, but they are counted as a strange thing. Now, that's not literally what it means, complete. I've given them a complete law, a complete system of law to govern them as I want them to govern. Now, the Old Testament law was not perfect. It couldn't make a sinner righteous. Couldn't do that. It could tell you what was right and what was wrong when you had sinned. But it took the blood of Christ to redeem us from sin. Law couldn't do that. That's what Paul's arguing in Romans and Galatians. Law couldn't do that. Because law can tell you what's right or wrong, and when I transgress it, the law can never justify me in his transgression. Now then, God said, I gave you the 10,000 things of my law. That means a complete and perfect number of them. I gave you the law that would have regulated you and kept you in my favor. But what do they become? A strange thing unto you. And that's what's happened today in our country. And I think it's happening a great deal in the church. I don't think the church today is studying the Bible and learning. It's too much sermon, and sermonettes, and sermonizing, rather than attempt to understand the book, to learn the book itself, to learn what's in it. And my aim in preaching and teaching since my early days has always been trying to try to get people to understand the book, be able to correlate it together, and understand God's whole overall purpose and plan of salvation. That you can understand then when I read this, it's got to be in harmony with this over here. That'll keep a fellow from going the wrong way. But when just a little sermon here and a sermon yonder, jumping here and yonder, you don't learn very much. That's why I think the expository type of preaching that I'm doing here, I think it's the best. You may not. I don't know what you think about it, but I think it's the best because I think we'll learn more if we pursue our own study of it. After that, if we don't, then we don't learn anything anyway. You don't. What you hear from a pulpit or in a class only gives you an opening for your own study to learn. If you don't pursue it, you don't learn very much more. Just kind of, it just doesn't fit. You don't fix it in your mind. That's why we've got to be more than just what you learn here. Anyway, we'll pull that in. As for the sacrifices of mine offerings, they sacrifice flesh and eat it. So they claim to be offering it to me, but they really, it's for themselves. Well, I think that's what a lot of religion is today, talking about being under God, but really it's under the individual himself. And I was reading something about Oral Roberts here last week, and how that he had deceived the people and all that, and knew better than what he was telling, but he was actually making his own money, filling his own pocketbook. But Jehovah accepted them not. Now will he remember their iniquity and visit their sins. They shall return to Egypt. And God said, no, you'll not go back down to Egypt. So what does he mean here? He means captivity. And he means bondage. Egypt became the symbol of bondage. So they're going back into bondage. I just keep that in mind till the next two or three verses. For Israel hath forgotten his maker and builded palaces, and Judah hath multiplied 45 cities. And I will send a fire upon his cities, and they shall devour the castles thereof. Now in 2 Chronicles 14, which we were reading the other night in our Bible study at home, we're reading the Old Testament right now, but in 14 and 6, here when Asa, who was a good king, one of the best that Israel had. Now when Asa became a king, look at verse 6, and he built 45 cities in Judah, for the land was quiet, and he had no war in those years, because Jehovah had given him rest. For he said unto Judah, let us build these cities and make about them walls and towers, gates and bars. The land is yet before us, because we have sought Jehovah our God. Yes, but now, that was really it. It's hard to build those cities. But he was putting his trust in the cities rather than in God. Now, he was a good man, a good king, one of the best. Asa and three or four of them were among the best. One or five or six good ones. But the difference between Judah and Israel was, Israel never had a good king, a king that worshipped Jehovah. 203 or 4 or 5 or 6 years, how long their history was, they never had a king that worshipped Jehovah. Now, Judah did. Now, Asa was one of them. That's 2 Chronicles 14, 6, if you didn't get the point there, where he built these cities there, and fortified places. Well, it might have turned out that. But now, what did Hosea say about him? He says here, now, Judah had multiplied 45 cities, but I'll send a fire upon his cities, and they shall devour his castles thereof. Now, what was the real protection of the nation? Faith in God. What is it, the real protection of this nation today? Righteousness exalteth a nation. Sin is a reproach unto any people. Proverbs 14, 33, I believe it is. And in Psalm 9 and 17, the wicked shall be turned back into Sheol, even all the nations that forget God. What is the first line of defense of this nation? It's not our atomic bombs, it isn't our military, it isn't our air force, it isn't our tanks, it's righteousness. I don't care how many tanks and bombs and all that we've got, unless the nation is righteous, when God says your time has come, he can turn those bombs right back upon you. He called them to blow up in your face there, whatever he wants them to do that. I figured it was speaking there. So remember that righteousness exalts the nation. That's the first line of defense, and not our bombs and tanks and navy and all that. Why not? Rejoice not, O Israel, for joy, like the peoples, that is your neighbors around you, the Gentiles, for thou hast played the harlot, departing from thy God, thou hast loved hire upon every grain floor. And apparently there was evidently a pause, a lull in a serious threat that God called them to rejoice, but it was premature. Or it might have been if they were rejoicing. This is in Jeroboam the second. Now remember back in verse 1 there, in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, and in the days of Jeroboam, the king of Israel. Right? This Jeroboam was a great military leader. He enlarged the borders of Israel, went and reconquered some of the lands they had lost, and so they were rejoicing in all that. But now God says here in Hosea, don't you rejoice, it's premature. Premature rejoicing now. For thou hast played the harlot, departing from thy God, thou hast loved high upon every grain floor. In other words, you have worshipped the Baals, for good harvest and good crops. When these come, you think the bales provided it. God said back in chapter 1, you remember, I'm going to take it away from you. I gave it to you. I'll take it away from you. But now, so they're high for worshiping the bales were their harvest. So they thought of the harvest as the high from the bales whom they worship. So then the threshing floor and the wine press shall not feed them, and the new wine shall fail her. In other words, that on which you're dependent will be lacking. It won't be there. They shall not dwell in Jehovah's land, but Ephraim shall return to Egypt, and they shall eat unclean food in Assyria. Now notice, up here in verse 13, he said they shall return to Egypt. Here he said they shall return to Egypt, and but they'll eat the unclean bread where? In Assyria. And God said in other places, you'll not go back to Egypt. So what Egypt stands for in those two verses, up here in verse 13 and down here in verse 3, Egypt stands for bondage. But the bondage will be where? In Assyria. Now they'll eat unclean bread in Assyria. To the Jew, anywhere outside of their own land there was unclean, an unclean land. And it was unclean bread there that they would eat. So what God is saying is, you'll be in bondage eating your unclean bread in this land and not in Jehovah's land. You'll be in a foreign land. So everything would be unclean to them there. And another point comes up in just a minute here. They shall not pour out wine offerings to Jehovah, neither shall they be pleasing unto him. Their sacrifices shall be unto them as the bread of mourners. All that eat thereof shall be polluted, for their bread shall be for their appetite. It shall not come into the house of Jehovah. Now why wouldn't it be able to pour out these offerings to Jehovah? Because only in Jerusalem, God said, I'll put my name where I put my name, there you shall come to worship. God put his name in Jerusalem. So when the temple would, or when they were left there and went up to Assyria, built Bethel and Dan, had to carry there, Israel, right? They couldn't really offer unto Jehovah. The only way they could was come back to Jerusalem. They didn't do that. Judah, when Judah offered a sacrifice to idols, she forsook Jehovah, so she would be carried away into another land, also an unclean land. So all of these expressions are pointing out here what would happen to them, but are based on their idolatry. They're leaving God out of their thinking. Our nation today is becoming idolatrous, you know that. It worships money, it worships power, it worships fame, it worships all of these things. We worship most anything except God himself. All right? But you can only worship God in the temple of God. What is the temple of God? It's the church made up of living stones. It's only within that relationship with God, where we're made up of living stones, that our worship can ever be acceptable. So when we leave God out, leave the church out, the church redeemed out, Christ out, his blood out, we've got no place to worship. We can't worship God acceptably apart from that. I think we all understand that. If we don't, we should understand it. Now, I don't mean this building. I'm talking about this. I'm talking about the church made of living stones, in which we are, Peter said, you also are living stones, are built up a spiritual house to offer spiritual sacrifices acceptable unto God through Jesus Christ. Right, that's 1 Peter 2 and 5. And that's so, you have a parallel there. Jerusalem, where the temple was the place to offer the sacrifices. And the church of the Lord, made of living stones, where the altar of sacrifice is, that's where we offer our spiritual sacrifice to him today. Okay, that'll answer the question about a lot of folks that think they can worship God just anywhere, and anything will suit him, anything goes, but it doesn't. Not any more today than it did back yonder. But still, everything within the realm of his plan and his purpose. Well, all right. Now he moves on to say here, although they are gone away unto destruction, yet Egypt shall gather them up. Yes, that's where I was now. What shall he do? No. Yeah, in Solomon, David Solomon sent it. Verse 6. Although they are gone away from destruction, yet Ephraim, Egypt, shall gather them up. And when they try to leave Jerusalem, to get away from the destruction that was coming, why, they caught up with them wherever they were. So they went to Egypt, and he said, Memphis shall bury them. That's one of the major cities down there. They shall bury them. Their pleasant things of silver, nettles shall possess them. Thorns shall be in their tents. All right, so later on, under Jeremiah, that'd be 100 years later, when Babylon conquered Jerusalem, took Jerusalem, destroyed it, they left a lot of the poor Jews in Judea, and Jeremiah chose to stay with them. They offered him an opportunity to go, and we'll take care of you if you want to go to Babylon. No, so I'll stay with my people. Well, the people took him and bound him and carried him down into Egypt with them in rebellion against God. Right, what does he say? He says, Memphis shall bear them. Now, Israel, they were carried into Assyria. Judah was carried into Babylon. It was only those who rebelled against God went down into Egypt, and there they perished there. But they were not carried down there. They went out voluntarily. Well, all right. And he says, the days of visitation are come. The days of recompense are come. Israel shall know it. The people, the prophet is a fool. The man that hath the spirit is mad for the abundance of thine iniquity and because the enmity is great. Now there are two interpretations of that passage. One is that he's talking about the prophets of Israel, that are the false prophets. They were fools there. The other is that the people were saying that the true prophet is a fool, that we don't listen to him. He's talking out of his, through his hat there. So I don't know which is correct. I rather think, though, that he's talking about the false prophets. Prophets there of Israel and Judah who are prophesying falsely. That we'll deal with those when we come to Micah. He deals with those more than we do right here. But anyway, either way, whether they were saying the true prophet's a fool, don't listen to him, or whether Hosea is saying your prophet is a fool because he doesn't have the Spirit of God in him, and so he's guiding you foolishly. It's either one or the other, and I don't know which it was. Now notice here, he says, is a fool, and the spirit is mad, and the abundance of your iniquity, because the enmity is great. That's why I think it's the fool, the prophet of those people there, prophesying falsely. Ephraim was a watchman, or watcheth against. Now, I don't know which this is. Was a watchman with my God, or he was a watchman against God. Now, the word used there can mean either one. You determine it by the context. So, the translators thought that Ephraim was a watchman with my God. I think the alternate reading is the better. I think Ephraim was a watchman against God. Now, you remember back in Ezekiel 3, in verse 16 along there, God said to Ezekiel, Son of man, I've set you a watchman of the house of Israel. Hear the word of my mouth and give them warning from me. Then he goes on to say, the fellow receives the warning will be blessed, he that doesn't, for I perish in that. But the prophet was a watchman. Now in the church today, the overseer, the elders are watchmen. Hebrews 13 and 17, they watch in behalf of your souls, they that shall give account. So they're watchmen. As a preacher, I'm supposed to be and am interested and concerned with the people of the congregation. I'm a watchman to see that I have responsibility. All right, now he goes on here, was a watchman, I think, against God. As for the prophet, a foul snare is in all his ways. And that would be those false prophets, for God's going to snare his. Remember that prophet, a daybreak, and fell, dropped at the dead at the door there. Well, this prophet, this Levite, cut her into 12 pieces and sent a piece to every tribe of Israel there. Horrible thing to do, that brought them together. Since this was in the tribe of Benjamin, they slew all the Benjaminites, except about 600 of them that escaped there. Later on, they had a feast there, and all the women out there, and this dance, or whatever it was. These men then went over here and hid, and they ran in, each one of them grabbed them a wife, and took her home with them, took them back over there, and that's the way they kept it. Benjamin from being destroyed. You remember that story? That's over there in the book of Judges there. But at any rate, I've always thought that would be a very interesting way to get a fellow wife, wouldn't it? And I look him over and grab him one, take off, wonder what he got. Kind of like looking for fries and popcorn, I mean, Cracker Jack, what he get in there. But it's an interesting way, but I believe I prefer my way to that way. Oh, at any rate, pass on that. That was Gibeah, and the days of Gibeah, he would remember their iniquity, he would visit their sins, just as God did back there in the days of Gibeah, when they acted like they did. Now notice, I found Israel like grapes in the wilderness. I saw your fathers as the first ripe in the fig tree at its first season. But they came to Baal Peor and consecrated themselves unto the shameful thing and became abominable like that which they loved. Now, God found them as you'd find fresh grapes after the winter of no fresh fruit. And here you find these grapes and all this luscious. Here are the fresh ripe figs, always a coveted dainty. And God found them like that, but they disappointed. And when they came to Baal Peor, that's in Numbers 25, that's where the women of Moab came out and persuaded the men to come and join them in that lascivious pagan worship, which involved fornication. On 23,000 of them were slain there. So you remember that probably. And so that's what he's talking about here. So what the prophet is talking about here rests on so much of the past history up to this point. So he said, I found it like grapes here that came to Baal Peor, consecrated themselves unto the shameful thing and became abominable like that which they worship. Look, as for Ephraim, now that word Ephraim, the word Ephraim means double fruitful. So Ephraim is the meaning of the word Ephraim. As for Ephraim, their glory shall fly away like a bird. There shall be no birth and none with child and no conception. I know instead of being double fruit, it'll be double barrenness, no fruit. All right? Though they bring up their children, yet will I bereave them, so that not a man shall be left. A woe also to them when I depart from them. Ephraim, like as I have seen Tyre, is planted in a pleasant place, but Ephraim shall bring out his children to the slayer. All right, now Tyre is on the Mediterranean coast northwest of Judah, and has beautiful mountains in the background, a beautiful sea coast here before them. Beautiful place. They had timber back here that they could cultivate and ore and all minerals, and traveled the sea, and they turned to the sea for their livelihood. All right, now God put Ephraim in a pleasant place. Here was the Mediterranean. He was farther south, Mediterranean. Here were the hills and the mountains here of Ephraim there. Beautiful country and a very fine country. God gave it to them. But what did they do with it? Yet he said, you're going to bring out your children to the slaughter. And instead of being double fruit, double disaster. Let me hurry through. All right. Woe unto them when I depart from them. Ephraim, like as I have seen Tyre, is planted in a pleasant place, but Ephraim shall bring out his children to the slayer. Give them, O Jehovah, what wilt thou give? Give them a miscarrying womb and dry breasts. In other words, and no children at all. Double barren. Double fruit to double barren. Barrenness. All thy wickedness is in Gilgal. That's the place, you remember, where they crossed over the Jordan and they circumcised there and rolled back the reproach. And then later on, it was a place where Saul was made king, consecrated again. Another important place and things like that. But now it become a center of idolatry. For there I hated them because of the wickedness of their doings. I will drive them out of my house. That's out of my family. I will love them no more. So now then they become a double barren and low Ruhama without mercy. Low Ami, not my people. As we started off in the first chapter. I will love them no more. All their princes are revolters. Ephraim is smitten. Their root is dried up. Not double fruit anymore. Double barrenness. They shall bear no fruit, yea, though they bring forth. Yet will I slay the beloved fruit of their womb. My God will cast them away because they did not hearken unto him, and they shall be wanderers among the nations. So when the 10 tribes were carried into Assyria, they were lost there. When the Jews came back, there were a few came back of Israel. Now, one of them was a few from the tribe of Asher. Anna, over in the second chapter of Luke, Anna was of the tribe of Asher. See, back in my mind, seemed like I said Issachar here some time ago and talking about Anna. I don't remember. But anyway, she's a descendant of Asher. That's the only tribe mentioned in the New Testament that came back.